Song of Solomon, chapter 8. Here we go. Let me begin in verse 1, of course. Starts off a little awkward, but I'll explain. Oh, this is the Shulamite woman speaking to her beloved. Oh, that you were as my brother, that sucked the breasts of my mother. When I should find thee without, I would kiss thee, yea, I should not be despised. I would lead thee and bring thee into my mother's house, who would instruct me. I would cause thee to drink of the spiced wine, of the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand should be under my head, his right hand should embrace me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up nor awake my love until he please. So this seems awkward to us, right? She literally is requesting about her husband at this point. I wish you were as my brother. I wish you were family. Now that seems really, really hillbilly to us, right? Really, really hillbilly. But it isn't at all. Okay, here's the deal. And this is weird for us, and I think rightfully so, by the way. But public displays of affection between husband and wife were absolutely discouraged in this culture. It was an extremely modest culture, and just to kiss your wife or, you know, display some type of physical touch was frowned upon in this culture. And what it seems, and if you've kind of followed my train of thought in this, it seems that there has been a recent rendezvous, right? I take the position that she's just seeing her shepherd lover for the first time in a long time. And they're out there in public. They've just come together, and she's like, "Oh, I wish you were my brother right now." Because if it was a family member in that culture, public displays of affection are absolutely permissible and even expected. She's saying, "I want to kiss you from head to toe. I want to kiss your face. Oh, I wish you were my brother right now, so I could do that, and there wouldn't be any talk." Is the idea make sense? So that's again, we lose something here in the West. It is a Jewish piece of literature, and I believe that is the best explanation for what was being described there, okay? Now, personally, I think public displays of affection, assuming they're appropriate, are really important. I personally think, you know, married couples in the room, I'm no pro, by the way, I'm still learning. I've only been married for 25 years. I got a lot to learn, I get it. But showing affection, especially in front of our children, I think that's a big deal, personally. I think, you know, Lisa and Aaron's sons, all 8 of them, they ought to look at mom and dad and see, man, they are madly in love with each other, and it is disturbing. I think that. I think that says something to them. And I do know this. I do know in a culture where there's been a lot of, you know, sin and trauma and alcohol and victimization. Our culture here in Maine, I could spit some statistics out, right? But we've been through some things as family members. That chips away at that affection, I think. Do you know what I mean? And you know, men hugging their children or showing affection that's meaningful and loving, it's sadly a bit of a cold culture, you know? It shouldn't be. I think by the grace of God and by the shaping of his word and a time to heal, that's all very, very necessary. I get all that. But maybe we could get to this. I think this should be a goal, that there would be between man and wife affection, appropriate affection. Now, there can be inappropriate displays of public affection, of course. I'm not suggesting, you know. That wasn't in my notes. But you get it, okay? But to show affection appropriately, I think, says so much about our love and our union. Verse 2, I would lead thee and bring thee into my mother's house, who would instruct me. Again, here in the West, that's the weirdest place to bring your loved one, yeah, especially when you have a romantic intention. You know, things start to get heated up. You want to go to mom's? No. Heck no. But the idea is, I think there's a idea here, once again, of obvious accountability. This is someone that she is excited to bring home. There's a prize kind of concept here, right? And there's safety in home. And, you know, families did live together in those days. The Jewish wedding was really cool. The husband would go away after the betrothal. the yet-to-be husband would go away, and he would literally build an addition on his father's house, right? He would build an addition on his dad's house when that was done, and when the father, no one else, said, all right, you can go get your bride, he would run a lot of times in the middle of the night with the whole wedding party, and he would you know, lead his bride into his new home. But he was essentially taking his bride to his parents' house. It was a tight-knit crowd back then. And, you know, that is what it is. An apartment attached to my in-laws, I could see that being problematic in some cases. But, again, a different culture, but that's a lot of that is implied here, okay? And then obviously this metaphoric or poetic language, you know, drinking of the spiced wine, you know, pomegranate language, you know, left hand under my head, right hand embracing, that leaves very little to the imagination. But there is clearly a sexual, a very God-honoring, by the way, and beautiful sexual exchange between this husband and his wife. You guys remember way back in the second chapter where she was with her ladies? She was with, I believe, you know, a potential harem under King Solomon. Remember she started to talk kind of out loud in a daydream sense, and she's thinking about this guy, and she, if it's okay for me to say, she's kind of getting herself a bit aroused, you know, as she just expresses what she would love to do and that she'd love to be with this man, and then she kind of puts the brakes on. She's like, whoa, all right, I got to stop right there. I should not fuel this until there's an appropriate time, until it's ready to go forward. To me, in chapter 8, verse 4, she's with this guy at this point. There's no indication whatsoever. She's daydreaming. She's actually been reunited with this guy, and there's more and more evidence of that as we will study on. It's almost like now she's saying it kind of sarcastically, going, you know, in reflection, okay, now it's time, right? I've been saying this for months, just so you know, that I wouldn't get myself where until I saw you again. And the idea is, well, here you are. And you know, kind of take me, I'm yours, in a very beautiful and romantic sense. So it's cool. Verse 5. Who is this that comes up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved? I raised thee up under the apple tree. There thy mother brought thee forth. There she brought thee forth that bare thee. You know, it's very interesting to study this, guys, but everybody, I think, that I've read and studied agrees that this is probably some relative of the woman. Some relative. As this reunion has taken place, and they're kind of walking up over the hill, and her head is on him, and they've been recently reacquainted. I believe she's been rescued personally, but whatever. There's a relative that's saying, who's this? Like, in other words, where have you been? That's interesting. There's clearly been distance in this relationship. They've been reunited, and she is so thrilled to just be with this guy that as they walk, she's leaning on him. She just doesn't want to be apart from him. Which is beautiful, right? It's precious. And it says so much about their love. She's just at ease that they're finally together. But this is an observation from an outside party. Many people, and I think it's absolutely believable. I personally think it's probably her brother or one of her brothers because they voice some interesting things here right around the corner. But this lady is leaning on this man. As a description of her love and affection, and probably an unwillingness to be ever apart from him ever again. That's the idea. Remember that, married couples, when you felt that way, like you just didn't want to be apart ever again? You know, sometimes distance, you know, physical distance even, sometimes it really tests a marriage. And I know we don't like it, but sometimes in my marriage, and definitely in my ministry, and definitely in my line of work, the truth is there's months that I'm away from my wife physically, months at a time. This season that I'm currently in, I've been away from home for about 14 months. You know, most of my evenings I've been sleeping in southern Maine. Do my best to get back in the weekend, but haven't even always done that. And that's the way it's been. And how has that panned out in my relationship? Well, because we're together on a cause, we can physically be apart, and there's no issue. There's no issue. But it's important to be together in a cause. And we also have learned, my wife and I, that married life, real life, is seasonal. It's seasonal. There's seasons of this and seasons of that. But I think we get really off and we're setting ourselves up for great failure when we try to make every single day the same. Do you know what I mean? But the reality is there's seasons where soldiers go off to battle and there's seasons where they're home. And the Lord ultimately determines the steps of the righteous. And if we really are yielded to the Lord's will, he might send you off on a missions field. He might send you off here or there. And the truth is, if we are together, united around a cause, that is much more binding than being together physically even. Now, having said all of that, I can't tell you how awesome it is to lay down in a bed next to my good-smelling wife. You know, it's wonderful. I would rather be there than any place in the world. You understand that, right? Especially when you consider who I work with and the air mattress that's in the room next to me and all of the sounds that come out of the corner. You know, we're just working with a bunch of builders, and we just sack out on this floor with air mattresses, and I've slept like that for months. Yeah, I'd rather be home, right? I'd rather not eat at Applebee's. I'd rather not eat on the go. I'd rather eat lamb and Brussels sprouts that we grew on our own. I would rather be home, but there are seasons of life where I can't, for whatever the case may be, responsibilities. And man, to be united around a cause, whether it's the mission that God has given us or raising our sons, or in my season right now, I want to invest in my sons. We have always been in ministry, my wife and I. We've never been in a situation, because we've always been in ministry, where we've socked a bunch of money away to put our kids through college. I have a trade I can invest in my sons. And as they're adults, that's what I can do right now, and that's what I'm trying to do. Trying to teach my sons how to work and be part of a business and trying to instill in them a trade so I can check out and raise sheep and teach the Bible when I can't limp out of the truck anymore. That's my plan. Well, commit it to the Lord. He could have other plans. But it's a season, just a season. Who is this that comes from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? I raise thee up under the apple tree. Seems like, you know, this is a very meaningful place to this family. It actually seems where all of the births of this family took place. And so would they frequent this tree? Again, this isn't palace language, this is country language. But that tree seems to be a rendezvous point. And it goes back, it has some history in their family. Got a spot like that? Got a spot like that in your family where something took place there that's very meaningful and reunions happened there? Again, I think those landmarks personally are very important. This is the woman. This is the woman speaking to this man. This is a very thought-provoking paragraph. Look at verse 6. Sorry, I'll try to excite you better. Here we go. Set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is strong as death. I'm going to pause there and deal with that part. She says some interesting things beyond here. But man, this is appropriate, and this is huge. She wants confirmation from this man. Please communicate to me that your devotion to me is sealed. I want evidence. I want to see something on your arm. I want to see it outwardly that you are absolutely committed and devoted to me, period. And by the way, I think every lady who's married has every right to expect that, by the way. Show me that you love me. Demonstrate. I want a guarantee. And I love that. And it's really not funny. It's been kind of used, you know, the let me just say, the deadbeat that would say, I told you I loved you on the day that we married. When I change my mind, I'll let you know. That is a really lame thing to say, by the way. It really is. And if you've been guilty of saying that, shame on you. But one of our responsibilities, actually, as a husband, is to constantly affirm our love for our wife. Constantly affirm. I believe I owe that to my wife. And as we've grown, that's become more complicated. That's become more, it takes a greater amount of depth for me to convince my wife that I love her. It wasn't as easy as a chocolate bar. When we were young and there was a shallowness to our lives, truthfully, we haven't been through that much, to say I love you to my wife might mean on my way home, I got you some chocolate. Aw. And that was it. But try that now. Chocolate bar is coming back in my direction. Where are you? What are you? You know, it takes me to dig in a little. She wants and deserves, by the way, some depth at this point. But I absolutely believe that all these years later, it is still my responsibility to convince that woman. I'm pointing over here because she was just there. I don't know where she went. You saw her during worship. Where'd she go? You know she loves this kind of attention, so that's probably where she went. It's still my responsibility to convince that woman that I love her. And you know, she doesn't make it that difficult, to be honest. She's a pretty cool lady. If you know her, you understand. She's a pretty awesome wife. But I'm human, and I get selfish, and I get self-absorbed, and she's faithful to bring me out of my funk, and I'm grateful for that, too. But brothers and sisters, husbands in the room, this isn't an unreasonable request. Show me you love. Prove that you love. That's not I feel personally that comes down to their very makeup and wiring. And I think it's part of the responsibility of being a husband. This is personal, but you know, my wife and I have a thing. You know, every couple has a thing, right? Various things. But, you know, I say I love you to her, and she says I know. And that, no, truthfully, that's kind of our thing. Like, if I say I love you, babe, I know. I love that response, personally. I don't necessarily need I love you too. I don't have that need. I just want her to know that I love her. And if she can say I know you do, I've done my job. And that's kind of our thing, okay? And it's personal, but it's meaningful to me. If I say I love you, which happens, it's just cricket. I'm like, you know, then I know I got some work to do. But if she responds with, I know you do, it means that it's been a good week. Been a good hour, right? Then she goes from this. She's asking for evidence. She's asking for proof. She's asking for a seal that communicates, you know, love in their relationship. And then she says, which is awesome, love is strong as death. I think she just demonstrated a resolve in what she just survived or what she just resisted. And you guys kind of know my position on this. But then she says this, jealousy is as cruel as the grave. Well, that's a really interesting thing to say. This is definitely the female speaking, just so you know. We know that because of the original language and the gender that it's written in. This is the female speaking who says, jealousy is cruel as the grave. Now, why would she say that? Well, would you just put yourself in that man's position, assuming I'm right on my take on it? Would you just consider my precious bride was being paraded around in some harem with some wealthy king, and how can I ever touch that? How can I ever match that guy? And in this clear reunion, she says, man, our love is powerful. For the record, I resisted. Our love, I have demonstrated my devotion to you. And let me say to you, my beloved, jealousy is cruel. Don't let it ruin this. Don't let that ruin this. Please resist this jealousy that any one of us would be tempted to have this well up in us, right? You know, let me give you a dark side of Aaron and Lisa's wedding or Aaron and Lisa's marriage, because we're not perfect. We've been through a lot of stuff. And, you know, one of the things that we survived in our early marriage was horrible jealousy. And it was a difficult first, you know, honestly, 5 years. 5 years. Very difficult 2 or 3 years in the beginning. Now, I had to grow up. I had to realize that jealousy came from a very broken heart. And in my pride and in my youth, I did not get that. It was just annoying and overwhelming at times, truthfully. I mean, we couldn't, and you know, we wouldn't at this point, but we couldn't go to the mall. That's the worst place or the last place I want to be currently. But, you know, as a young couple, let's go to the mall. It just seemed like what you do. And what a horrible decision that always ended up being, right? I couldn't ever look in the right direction. What are you looking at? What are you looking at? And it was just like, you walk to the mall and you just feel like a zombie, like, And it was very, very difficult. And the jealousy was outrageous. But I had to grow up. I had to get over me. And I had to realize this poor woman, and I talked with her. Some of you saw maybe an exchange just before worship. I actually asked her permission to mention some of this in our little secret language way. And then she laughed. No, she did, but I don't think it's connected. She actually said she didn't feel that good. She's not known for lying, but strong possibility. But listen, jealousy almost ended my marriage. That's the truth. It almost destroyed us. And the solution wasn't, you get over it. The solution was, I had to grow up and realize that heart has been crushed over and over and over and over. Not just from other men, plenty of that, but from family members. That my wife, and I'm not trying to exploit her, you know, world or anything like that, or take advantage of her not being here, but she had been through a lot, and I had to get over Aaron and realize, man, there's an insecurity there. There is a broken heart there that if I keep doing this prideful, get out of my face, woman. I didn't marry a mother. That's how I used to respond to that. And it just made it more so. I was doing the opposite of what I should have been. I should have, and I've learned, and I'm happy to tell you, there is freedom in that relationship. This woman, once again, knows 98% of the time, you love me. I know you do. It's for keeps. Okay? I had to get over me and realize, man, I need to convince this lady that I love her. I need to convince this lady I am going nowhere. You are the only woman on this earth for me. The end. And it took some time to do that. It took some convincing because of what she had been through. But you know what? I love my wife, and it was a worthy cause, and I'm glad to tell you we can go anywhere now. And there just isn't that. There just, I can't even explain how the Lord worked in that area, but there just isn't that jealousy and that constant, you know, awareness. And I will say this, ladies, because I think it's helpful. It was such an obsessive thing with her as far as, you know, my eyes, and if there was anybody in the room that she felt threatened by, as far as maybe she's more pretty or clothing, of course, in this culture weighs in on all of this. You get it, right? You know, the fact that it was constantly being put in my face actually worked against me and constantly kept it in my heart and my mind. Do you understand what I'm saying? There was such an extreme jealousy. It's like everywhere I went, all I could think about was bodies and what was a prohibition. And that has an adverse effect. Are you with me? So trust the Holy Spirit shaping our lives after the Word and not being so pig-headed that I couldn't see it for what it was and minister to that heart. Boy, the Lord's taught us a lot. You know, He's taught us a lot. And there's still room for growth. I hope you understand that. No expert, but I'm just speaking out of my own experience. Some very important things. But this woman, I believe, looks right in his eyes, and I think she sees something. She knows this man. She knows him well. And she sees, of course he's glad to see her. I don't know if he ever thought he'd see her again, but he sees a flash in his eyes and says, I see that king, I am going to. And she's like, no, don't go there. It'll destroy everything. Jealousy is cruel as fire. It'll consume this. I think there's some, it's cruel as a grave. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which has a most vehement flame. Then she goes on to say this, many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. Listen, we just survived a tremendous trial, but we're intact. My resolve hasn't changed. And then this is an interesting statement. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would utterly be condemned or despised, some of your versions say. Do you know what she just said? For the record, you can't buy me. Or my love cannot be bought. I think that weighs heavily on, personally, my take on this. She says to her poor shepherd lover, for the record, let it be known, she's pointing in the direction of Solomon's palace, my love can't be bought because here I am. Awesome, right? Now, make that statement fit the other. I don't know how you do that. Because to be part of Solomon's harem, to be okay with that arrangement, you are being bought in my, well, at least I got a palace. At least I have a beautiful, you know, Ferrari. But yeah, I got to share him with 999 other ladies. But it's a Ferrari, you know, in beautiful shoes. I got tons of shoes. Do you understand? A lady that would be cool with that, and I'm assuming there's some level of her will. It probably wasn't the case, right? But there's a lot of material goods that would go along with that arrangement. That's my point. But she says, I'm not for sale. You are the one I love. Our love has been tested and it survived. And for the record, I am not for sale. Isn't that awesome? I think it's absolutely beautiful. Okay, the brothers are back in the scene, okay? The brothers that I believe said in verse 5, who's this? Who's this? Look, they're together again. And they're kind of celebrating the reunion. And then the brothers say this, and again, hear it. Hear it culturally. Hear it accurately. We have a little sister, and she has no breasts. In other words, she's yet to go through puberty. I think we can handle that. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken for? So here you have the brothers, I believe, of this Shulamite woman, and they're reminiscing. They've already gone to the apple tree where they were probably born, and there's all this reminiscing. There's a reunion, and these brothers are kind of talking out loud about their baby sister and suggesting, you remember when she was young? And as brothers, we're like, okay, she's about to enter into puberty. What's our plan? First of all, I absolutely love that. I absolutely love that. One of the reasons why I always wanted a daughter, God never gave me one, but just that dynamic to me is so powerful. And any of you Christian brothers in the room, I think you should pop a punk right in the nose if he messes with your sister. I think that is so godly personally. And mom and dad, I'm really sorry for saying that if you disagree. But can you think of anything more honorable for a brother to walk up to some punk who sees your sister as a means for his pleasure? Man, plant one right there. Just what? Isn't that an awesome thing? And I see this here. I hope that's not too dramatic. But I see, you know, this plan being made. You know, we have a little sister. She's vulnerable. She's not yet gone through puberty. What are we going to do? What's our game plan? I think parents probably can weigh in on this or understand this. And here's their conclusion. Here's their game plan. I think this is really fascinating. Verse 9, if she be a wall, we will build upon her a palace of silver. If she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. Well, as we see this young lady develop, as she gets older and starts making decisions, here's what we're looking for. Is she a wall or is she a door? If she is a wall, if she builds this resistance to this sensual culture, a wall has no access. A wall is just that. It's a wall. It's a wall, buddy. Got it?
Got it.
See ya. If she is a wall, then we will pour out blessings and favor. We will build a palace of silver. In other words, we will give her responsibilities, honor that's deserved. If she holds herself as a wall, but if she's a door opens. A door opens frequently. A door is accessible. If she's a door, then we will remove her liberties and make it very difficult for her in her position to move forward with that. Isn't that awesome? What good parenting even that weighs in as we, and here's the reality. I've raised 8 sons. They're not all the same. I've watched it up close, and so have you, parents. The same tutelage, the same Bible, the same education, the same hard lessons, the same family models, and you have very different kids growing up, don't you? And some of them respond very well to that. Some have a rebel in them. They want to test everything. And some of our sons have grown up as a wall. You're not getting through this. I have convictions. I have things that have been. And then some grow up and they're much looser with their standards. Well, the ones that present a wall, you pour out blessings on that. You reward that behavior as they resist this world. But the ones that are much more open, then I think it's absolutely right to limit liberties and build some restrictions around that. Because here's the beautiful thing. In this culture, and I hope it's beautiful to us, whatever we gotta do to encourage and protect and promote virginity and purity, we're the deal, right? We will lock her up if she demonstrates anything less than a wall. If she wants to demonstrate herself as a wall, we will reward that. I love that. I absolutely love that approach. I got a granddaughter, and I know she's got a dad that would take. I know she's got some uncles. She definitely has a granddaddy that's really deadly when it comes to this kind of thing. And we'll see. We'll see if we can stay out of jail, right, Dylan? We'll do our best. Then she goes here. She says, this Shulamite woman, I believe they're reflecting about her when she was young, and I think she says, for the record, I am a wall. And this sounds in our culture weird, but my breasts are like towers. A tower is defendable, right? It's strong. It's always watching for the enemy. In other words, my city's not going to be invaded. That's kind of the idea here. A bit poetic, and we, because of our sensual culture, we get a different idea. But that's what's being described there. Then was I in his eyes as one that found favor. Because she was indeed a wall, she has seen and enjoyed all this favor all around us. And then verse 11, Solomon comes into the picture. Solomon, she's speaking of Solomon as if over there. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. You know what that means? Solomon had a vineyard. What did he call it? Lord of Abundance. Now, there's no other place in the scriptures that this shows up. This seems very tongue-in-cheek. This seems very in jest. Oh, what did he call it? That's right. He called his vineyard Lord of Abundance or possessor of an abundance. He had a garden. He had a vineyard. Everywhere in this book, my vineyard, my garden, it's a symbolic word that's used to describe an individual's sexuality. Study it. My garden, my vineyard, my garden, my vineyard. As a description of the individual's sexuality. You know, I let my loved one into his garden. He ate all the fruits. And that's a clear picture of a romantic exchange. She speaks of Solomon as having a vineyard by the name or in the location of Lord of Abundance. And he let out the vineyard unto keepers. His sexuality, what he had in his, he lent it out to keepers. He was very loose with his sexuality, okay? Are we following the train of thought? Everyone for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. In other words, he did this for personal gain. But then she says, in some of your newer translations, which I love, it actually has a conjunction, but. The NLT, the NIV starts this next verse with but. I don't think there's a conjunction there, personally, as I've said it, but my old English Bible and many of your other Bibles say my vineyard. It definitely draws distinction between his vineyard and my vineyard. It definitely draws a distinction. And check it out. My vineyard, which is mine, is before me. Thou, O Solomon, must have 1,000, and those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. In other words, in your arrangement, Solomon, you are the one that benefits the most. And everybody that participates in your little game gets minimal from it. I have my vineyard, and I have preserved it and protected it. That's the statement there. At the end of this book, that's what she is shouting and celebrating. You got your garden. And it's all about you, and everybody involved gets minimal compared to what you get. I have my vineyard, and I've protected it. Isn't that beautiful? It really is. Thou that dwell in the gardens and the companions hearken to your voice, cause me to hear it. That's a male voice. That's a male voice. All right, you've made your statement. You've spoken how you feel to all your ladies. Now let me hear that voice. The beloved, you know, weighing in as we exit this book. And then she says, in the last statement, make haste, my beloved, and be thou like a roe or to a young hart upon the mountains of spices. In other words, she's longing to be with him. I think their relationship was threatened on one of those occasions where he came home unexpected. They were fighting, you remember, and that's where she got taken away. But now, as she lies there in bed, she says to her shepherd lover who's off in the mountains doing his shepherd job, I can't wait till you get home tonight, or I can't wait till you get home this morning, whatever the case may be. That's how the book ends, a longing in her heart to be with this man. No doubt absence has, you know, made them fond of each other. There you have it, Song of Solomon. Let's close in prayer and we'll fellowship. Lord, we love you and we love what you've done in our lives. And Lord, I know every husband in this room, if he was up here, he'd speak fondly of his wife, no doubt. Lord, I know some good Christian men in this room, great Christian families in this room. Would you protect them? Would you preserve them? Lord, give us wisdom. We don't want to compromise. We don't want to take for granted even what you've done in our marriages, Lord. And I certainly pray that the world would look in at your church and see a kind of love and devotion and productivity that comes out of our homes that causes them to be curious and maybe even could draw them to you. And Lord, any marriage in this room that's struggling, maybe some of the things that were mentioned because of a history or difficult traumatic events, Lord, there's just a wall in some cases. I pray that you'd bring healing, your truth into that situation. I pray that you certainly bring a faith and a dependency on your word and an obedience to your word, Lord. Regardless of feelings, help them to obey your word and then watch things heal in time, Lord. Help us to trust you in all these things. And Lord, as we fellowship and pray for one another and interact, we just pray that your spirit would be very much a part of what we're doing. Thanks for the whole weekend, Lord. You've been faithful. And Lord, would you please bless our afternoon in Jesus' name. Amen.